From the studios of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. More women from around Fiji's remote islands are calling in to report abuse after the launch of a toll-free domestic violence hotline last week. While the Fiji Women's Crisis Center has run the hotline for more than 30 years, calls are now free after a deal was struck with Fiji's home phone companies and the government. The crisis centers, Shamina Ali told Sally Round, the toll-free calling number is obviously making a difference.
The significance, first of all, is that the profile of domestic violence has been lifted because the government is partnering with us. It's a toll-free line, and it has been launched with a lot of fanfare. And this will enable women who often are poverty-stricken to call. It will enable them to call a toll-free line so they can have access to any phone. I can ask people for their phones and call the toll-free line. In the last 2 or 3 days, we've already had over 40 calls. It does seem that a toll-free line makes a lot of difference in women's lives. They have given us the funding to do this for a year. Then we'll have to discuss the future of it. We have just employed 4 more new counselor advocates. I've got a team of about 11 counselors. So all of them take turns, but about 4 of them have been specially trained, and they are training other people how to do this because the system is quite complex, and it's going to be very easy to collect data, also to look at trends and things like that.
You said you've had 40 calls in the last couple of days. How many would you normally have had without the toll-free number?
In a whole week, we might get about 20 calls or so, almost half of that, yeah. 20, 25 calls in a week, yeah. There is like new people calling in, yeah.
This is going to be a huge upswing in your work then. Do you think you've got enough resources?
Yes, we have. You see, because we already have had the 30 years of experience. So it's not like a new set of people doing this work. We know where the referral services are. We know how to make the other service providers do the work. You know, we know how to get things going. So that is why, we are able to cope. We thought very carefully about it. We planned it very well with the counseling staff, with the counseling department of the crisis center. We do realize it's an enormous task we have ahead of us, but we have full confidence that because of our experiences of being around for 32 years doing this work, knowing all the pitfalls as well as all the good things that can happen, we are quite confident that we will be able to cope.
So basically the significance of this toll-free line is that you're opening this up to people, as you say, who can't afford to call in, who may be in remote areas, I guess.
Yes, very remote areas. You know, we're already getting calls from the maritime areas, which is a really good thing because that is where the outreach is the least. And also the national survey on intimate partner violence indicates that the Eastern Division, which is mostly made up of the maritime areas, has highest prevalence rates. So this is also a good way to reach out to them. Most of the calls have been on domestic violence. And, you know, we get other calls for child abuse, inaction from other service providers. And those are the usual kind of calls we get at the crisis center also. But the trend we are seeing just in the last 3 days is about lack of responses or appropriate responses, which we have always outlined as a challenge from some service providers. Also, as usual, get the men calling who also are having issues of their wives have run away or something like that. And how can we help them? So we refer them to the appropriate service provider.
Tonga's government is looking for more than $50 million to deal with climate change issues in the country. The Environment and Climate Change Minister, Susia Suvivelli, says there are highly vulnerable communities where coastal erosion, flooding, and immune problems need urgent attention. He told Corey Hawkins this is why the government will apply to the UN's Green Climate Fund in April for finance.
This is our first proposal to the Green Climate Fund. We take it very seriously. We consider some of the organizations that we can partner with to actually try and get some assistance. And we got UNDP and SPREP as our partners to actually develop this proposal. And we're starting in January, and we're in the stage now that we are ready to actually submit it. And part of the reason why we had that appraisal workshop last week is that we got most of the information together, and we just want to present it to the various stakeholders here in Tonga to actually get their final feedback before we finalize the proposal and send it to the Green Climate Fund.
How much is needed and what will it be used for?
It's around about $50 million US. Part of it is a request to TCF, but there are also other partners who are actually helping. It's about coastal protection and what can we do about protecting and help mitigate the erosion problems that we have in coastal areas. And we're focusing on four areas. There's coastal protection for our eastern side and our western side and also Ha'apai. And we've got other activities about working with SMAs and about working with Goros and so forth, especially in Wawa'u. But primarily the big components are coastal protection for Ha'apai and Tongatapu.
You mentioned this will be the first application. Is that because the issues have become more prevalent recently?
Basically, part of it was actually getting Tonga ready to actually submit such a proposal and finding the right partner. And the fact that this is our first one actually shows how important protecting our coastal villages are to Tonga. I know that's why this is going to be the first proposal we are sending to the Green Climate Fund.
Do you know roughly how many people these issues are affecting and impacting?
In Ha'apai, we're talking about a couple thousand people. In the eastern side, similar numbers. But more importantly, even with the coastal protection, because most of our road tend to be on the coastline. And if we don't do something about it, it will also affect our those key infrastructure. And that will affect people down the road who actually need those roads for transportation. The two components are here in Tongatapu, where 70 to 80% of the population of Tonga resides.
When we're talking coastal protection, are we talking planting, seawalls? What are we talking?
We were talking about revetment to actually protect. We've got some initiative, we've got some project there with the European Union whereby we're actually trying to get the sand back. But this will actually provide some protection to minimize the erosion and the potential effect on the roads. Those are key infrastructure, not only for transportation purposes, but also for accessing plantation and so forth.
The latest estimate of HIV-infected people in Papua New Guinea is around 40,000, up from 25,000 people in 2013. The National AIDS Council's Manager for Research, Tony Lepiwa, says the infection prevalence rate of those who are tested is around 0.8%, up from 0.5% in 2013. Suspecting the increase is linked to widening data collection, Mr. Lupia says the overall situation is improving, but there's still much work to be done. However, he told Johnny Blades that because of government funding shortages, the HIV/AIDS awareness campaign has been slowing down in recent years.
But we are preparing in a big way to go out to do some more mass awareness and distribution of condoms to every corner of Papua New Guinea, because we have the elections coming up. In the past, we have had increased number of cases after the elections, because election time, people are moving into the areas where the intending candidates are. There's a lot of money and beer and drugs that results in unsafe sex. Take the message out to the people that HIV is still here and that everybody should take precautions during this national election. And if you're going to have sex, have safe sex with a condom. That sort of information will be going out.
Are there any particular regions or provinces where the infection rate is worse compared to the rest of the country?
The Highlands provinces have the greater number of people living with HIV. The PNG HIV epidemic has now been downgraded to a concentrated epidemic, and it's only in certain provinces among key populations. Key populations are those who are female sex workers, men who have sex with men, transgenders, and businessmen with money.
It's not worsening as an overall problem in PNG. You think it's getting better?
It's getting better. It's getting better, but there's still more to be done. And we must not become complacent. We have to continue to go out there and make that awareness and make the condom available to everyone in the community to have access to it. Not just condoms, but also ART available to those who are living with HIV. We got that goal, and that is 90% of people who are tested positive taking ART. ART is antiretroviral therapy.
So that controls it?
Yeah, that controls it. That prevents people from dying early. They live a normal life. And at the same time, if their viral loads are decreased down to an undetectable level, then they don't transmit to their sexual partners.
What's the current coverage of the ART? How many people who are infected have access to it?
Yeah, currently it's about 65% of people on ART, so we're trying to reach that 90%. 90% coverage by 2020.
Papua New Guinea wants greater control over the aid Australia provides to PNG. The call was made last week at the annual Australia-PNG ministerial meeting for the $377 million US dollars Australia provides each year to go directly into the budget. It is not a new call, and the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, says it would be more efficient and cut out the wastage and duplication of administrative systems. He told the Post Courier newspaper that under the present system, there are too many middlemen costing too much money, meaning less reaches the intended objectives. Don Wiseman asked the executive director of the Institute of National Affairs, Paul Barker, what he thought of the idea.
Well, in principle, it's a sound concept, and it's certainly been the direction that all aid donors around the world have, in principle, sought as a more efficient mechanism that harmonizes the aid with the priorities of the country. But in practice, is clearly dependent on a whole range of governance criteria being in place and meeting adequate levels of accountability and synchronization of priorities.
Papua New Guinea in that regard can't present a very good case to Canberra, can it?
Not really. The government and the planning minister who was putting it forward in those ministerial talks has certainly been pushing for trying to get the government budget much better aligned with development priorities within the country, aligned with a set of frameworks right down to the local level that require facilities, public goods such as health services, schools, roads and so on to be financed and accessible to the public. But as we know, the reality, and this is a concern that stretches across the country, especially when you move out of the national capital, move into any of the provinces, they see the money having been concentrated, expenditure concentrated in the national capital in a range of infrastructure projects, some of which are finished, others are not, in the national capital, while the rest of the country is struggling to try and maintain basic access facilities and other public goods, which have extensively seen over the last period of time teachers being unpaid and health workers likewise, and inadequate funds to meet even the commitments that the government has made in terms of free education and free health services and so on. So, yeah, there's a big gap between the rhetoric and the reality.
The New Zealand government, with its aid over the last 3 or 4 years, has been putting money with a number of Pacific countries, putting it directly into the budgets. I imagine Australia's doing this as well in some of the smaller Pacific countries. And I guess just that's the factor, they're small, easier to manage, easier to keep an eye on where the money goes. But the problem for PNG is the complexity of the country.
Well, yes, up until the beginning of the 1990s, the Australian government did put the funds through direct budget support, and that came under a certain level of concern, criticism within Australia that the money was increasingly being diverted in on directions. As more, you might call them slush funds, like the sectoral program and so on, and developed in PNG, and funds seemed to be becoming less accountable, managed less accountably. So, yes, after the Australian assistance increasingly moved across to project aid, yes, the management did become more cumbersome, and you did get a lot, in a way, more bottlenecks and more staff having to spend their time focusing on planning, midterm reviews, this, that and the other. And the development outcomes of all that probably are very mixed. Yes, if one can get the government systems up and running, effective and accountable, and certainly the Australian government is trying to assist with improving governance mechanisms, including training for the public service and so on, that's all very well and good. But as we know, it doesn't sort of happen overnight, and there has to be that fundamental commitment to good governance, addressing accountability. And although we see it in some individuals, we're not seeing it effectively right through the government system here yet. Yeah, if all players can work together, civil society and government working together to try and address the issues of governance, then in due course of time, that would hopefully be addressed. But in a forum that we were in last week in the Highlands, both civil society players, but also government people, including the governor of the host province, Juwaka, said basically our systems are pretty well stuffed. We're failing to deliver essential services. We're having too many tiers of government. Our mechanisms seem to be undermining the capacity of those tiers of government to deliver. So we've got to actually come together and to rationalize that and address those challenges.
The importance of small boat safety in the region is being reiterated by the Pacific Community, that's SPC, after the successful rescue of two fishermen in Tuvalu. The two, Tuvaluan Semi Saga and Fo Tavala, had been trolling off Futafuta in Funafuti on the 28th of February when their lines got entangled and fouled up their propeller. After trying everything they could to get back underway and contact people offshore via radio, the pair set off on a personal location beacon in their grab bag, sending a signal to search and rescue authorities in New Zealand, who informed Tuvaluan authorities, who managed to pick up the men after 15 hours adrift. Both fishermen praised the usefulness of the emergency equipment kit in the grab bags and recommended every fisherman have one of them with them on every fishing trip. The Director General of the Pacific Community, Colin Tukalokagonga, spoke to Karori Hawkins about the emergency grab bag initiative, beginning with a description of the contents in each kit.
A large waterproof grab bag. This is the bag that you put the stuff in. Three inflatable life jackets. One personal locator beacon. This is really the key thing, because if you're lost in the big blue, this is sends the signal out to the New Zealand Air Force, Orion.
Yes,
okay?
Yes.
So this is the main event. But it's got a medical kit. It's got a whistle, a strobe light, a VHF, handheld VHF radio, 3-4-pack batteries, a sea anchor, a map compass, a blanket, and a thermal bag. It's got pretty much everything you'll need at sea.
Quite an impressive emergency kit that is. And how many of these bags have you given out, and to whom?
Well, Tuvalu is the poster boy, because they have on a number of bags per small boat. They've exceeded themselves. We gave them, well, EU money, 30 bags, and they went off and bought 128 themselves. So we're really pleased with this. The whole thing costs $1,200 US.
Yep.
And you know, what's the cost per hour to get an Orion out of Auckland?
Way more than that.
Yeah, well, exactly. So each bag is $1,200, and that would be a fraction of an hour of the Orion time, right? So Tuvalu, we gave them 30 back in late 2015, and they ordered 128 more for themselves. But we gave some out to PNG, Vanuatu, Tuvalu, Tonga, and Niue.
And there's been a success story in the past few weeks. I understand a couple of men have been rescued, having used the equipment in the bag.
Yes, on the 28th of February, two guys from Tuvalu set out fishing and was adrift for some 15 hours because their boat broke down. And so they set this thing off and they were pretty much picked up safe and sound.
Do you envisage putting more of these bags out there? It seems like a very important initiative. Is there funding to get more bags out into the Pacific?
Well, the European Union money for this project, DevFish 2, has ended. But I think people need to understand that it's our business. Small boat safety is our business, and we've been at this game since 1995. And chances are, whilst this particular EU-funded project has ended, we will no doubt continue to do this. Because this is part and parcel of small boat safety. So we just handing out the bags is just one, you need to educate the people how to use them and so on. And we've run small engine maintenance type training around the islands. This is just normal part of SBC, coastal fisheries guys working with the islands.
The Biosecurity Authority of Fiji has stopped a Korean cargo ship from entering Fijian waters after it was ordered to leave New Zealand. Dense fouling and barnacles on tube worms were discovered on the hull of the DL Marigold, posing an invasion threat of unwanted marine species. Bren Drawbridge has been following the story and gives the latest to Karori Hawkins.
So what do we know about this boat, Ben?
Fiji authorities say it's hauling palm kernel for dairy feed. It docked in the New Zealand port of Tauranga on Saturday, March the 4th, and upon inspection by divers, it was discovered that its hull was encrusted with barnacles and tube worms to an extent where it was felt that if any of those organisms detached from the hull, it could pose a biosecurity threat. So it was given 24 hours to leave New Zealand on Sunday the 5th of March, and this was the first time that an international vessel had been ordered to leave New Zealand for what they call biofouling. The crew at that point signalled its intentions to go to Fiji to clean the hull and to return to New Zealand to finish offloading its cargo. But before it entered Fijian waters, the Biosecurity Authority of Fiji notified the ship's India-based agents that it was not welcome.
And what reasons did the Fijian Biosecurity Authority give for rejecting the vessel?
Well, the authority's chief executive, Xavier Khan, said the DL Marigold could cause biofouling, resulting in the introduction of invasive aquatic species in Fiji waters. He says this could be devastating for Fiji's marine and aquatic species. Mr. Khan said the organisms on the ship's hull could establish a reproductive population in the host environment, becoming invasive, outcompeting native species and multiplying into pest proportions. He said invasive species were already causing enormous damage to biodiversity in Fiji and its valuable natural resources, which Fijians depend on.
And where will the vessel go now?
Well, I've contacted the company that Fiji indicated was the boat's shipping agent, Campbell Shipping. And Campbell says the DL Marigold is not part of its fleet. The Korean company Daleam lists the DL Marigold as being part of its fleet, describing it as a bulk and log carrier. I've not received a response from Daleam to my questions about the boat's new destination. Vessel tracking websites, however, indicate the boat is still on course for Fiji. They also tell me it was built in 2012, so it's quite a new boat, and it's a big one, 180 metres long. I suppose there could be a danger now that the boat has been stigmatised and no Pacific port will allow it to dock, especially now that the Fiji Department of Environment praised blocking the vessel as an exemplary approach in protecting its oceanic patch. That was a stand the department felt Fiji had to make, given that it's co-hosting this year's United Nations Oceans Conference.
The Natural University of Samoa is expanding the media and journalism course to a bachelor's degree in 2018. The journalism course started as a certificate program and then upgraded to a diploma, and next year it'll be a degree program. Samoa's Journalism Association, or JAWS, says the move is in recognition of the important role the media now plays in everyday life in Samoa. Its president, Upulu Lance Pulu, spoke to Maria Tapempa Taylor about the move.
It has to happen because we need to lift the entry point so that the quality of the students that we get after the training, the quality students that we require to deliver in service of the industry and ultimately the Samoan public.
I guess, too, the way we tell stories has also changed with social media and other aspects as well. So that also will be quite good training ground about how things have changed, obviously, over the years.
Yeah, well, certainly we, Samoan as a Polynesian and perhaps any other traditional society with a very firm and a very strong oral tradition, telling stories and communicating through the word of mouth and passed through generations. So it's that skill and that knowledge and the art that needs to be to have modern ways of delivering and telling those stories through pictures and sound and the word itself. So perhaps that's what we're looking at here. And of course, you may know that Samoa over the last 10, 15 years, the explosion of the media has been so that we have the major players in society, like the churches, who now run their own television and radio stations and newspapers and online stuff. Other than the privately owned media. So there is that need for the properly trained personnel to deliver that, and perhaps marrying that traditional knowledge of telling stories and the oral traditions that within us, and then using the new technology through the cameras, the sound bites, the images that we use, and the other very significant skills like animation and that stuff, telling the stories in a different way and in a more interesting way, so that that will continue on into the future. So, yeah, there are exciting times, and I hope that the course will deliver that.
Have you seen the numbers increase in terms of young people interested in looking at media as a future career?
You and I know that the parents will always be pushing for their child to be doing law or doing accountants or accountancy or economics or that kind of stuff. And the media is usually the last that they will take. But so that's perhaps one of the reasons why they elevating the entry point, so that it will make it more appealing to the parents. And with the way that the media is really in a high profile in a country, I think that will also help. But yes, it's all that. It's lifting the entry point and, of course, looking at where we can actually deliver and teach and produce students who can actually help out and do the work in a very professional way and in the standard that is really, really high for Samoa.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to our programs again and again by visiting the Focus Asia webpage at PCJ, which is pcjmedia.com, and just click on Focus Asia Pacific. We are making a big change to the PCJ website, which will be happening on May the 1st. That's right, a whole new website on May the 1st with better content for the program. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Parot wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.